Well, hello, and welcome to the PGPC podcast. My name is Jared Kieber. I'm your host. As always, you can check out our website at PrinceGeorgePentecostalChurch.com. We would love to hear from you. Drop us a line. You can click on sermons, and there is a sermon series entitled podcast. There's a form you can fill out on there, and we would love to, of course, hear from you. Well, one of the things that I love about the place that I live, both the province and the city specifically, is the fact that if you like outdoors types of things, there is no shortage. And so in Prince George, if you like fishing, there is fishing, great fishing. If you like hunting, there is the ability to go out and hunt, although I haven't done super well in that area over the last number of years. There's hiking. There's just a ton of stuff that you can do outside. And I know, you know, if you generally are a little bit closer to bigger cities, some of those things you say, oh, you know, I hunt, and people will look at you kind of funny. But in Prince George, everybody does it. So nobody really looks at you funny if you hunt and fish and that sort of thing. So I enjoy that because I grew up hunting and fishing. And for me, that was a huge part of my family heritage. But somewhere along the line, I think I realized that things like hunting and fishing, and if you're not into hunting and fishing, maybe you're backpacking or just even looking at scenery, and you can get that walking through a city or pretty much anywhere where you look at the earth, essentially, and you go, man, this is really cool. There's some cool things here. And so what I've done is I've actually leaned on that as a way of saying, you know what, I think that there is something oriented within this reality of looking at what I would call creation that speaks to a creator. And so a couple of years ago already, a friend asked me to speak at an event that they do is a wild game banquet, which was just awesome. The food was great, and just the whole event was really well done. I thought it was really cool to have a church putting on a wild game banquet. And so I said, yeah, you know what? I would love to do that. And so I wrote a bit of a story kind of inspired by a guy you may be familiar with named Stuart McLean, who's passed away. But I think Stuart McLean was just a great storyteller. And so what I did is I wrote kind of an account of my kind of history growing up as someone who loves things like hunting and fishing, and how I think that those things actually point us towards a creator, specifically, of course, the Christian God in Jesus Christ. And so I decided on this episode to share this with you, and I hope that you enjoy it. It's called Great Things for Greater Things. I come by my passion for hunting honestly. My grandfather was a taxidermist, and my dad worked alongside him before going to school to become a pastor. While vocationally I've followed in my father's footsteps, I often dream of taking up the prior family trade and trying my hand at taxidermy. When talking about possible future renovations for our home, I told my wife I could turn the rental suite into a taxidermy shop. She laughed at me. She also laughed at me for watching hours of instructional videos on YouTube. I tell her it's like reality TV, which she loves dearly, only it's actually real. Anyways, having grown up in a home in which hunting played a large part, I have a rich store of memories revolving around the sport or lifestyle, if you prefer. Perhaps the earliest memory I recall is my dad waking me up well before light one morning when we lived in Burns Lake. He asked me if I'd like to go hunting with him, and I didn't have to think twice. On the one hand, it meant I would be partaking in the family pastime, and on the other, it meant that I would get to miss school. Later on in my formative years, I never missed an opportunity to do either, much to the chagrin of my mother. I always referenced one of our family friends who wrote a note to his daughter's school stating, "Tracy missed school with a case of buck fever. She had to go and see Doc Nature." That morning with my dad, we didn't shoot or even see anything, an experience we've repeated many times since. But a seed was planted deep within my soul. That seed would grow into a full-fledged love of being outdoors, especially when being outdoors entailed hunting. A few years later, I found myself in the position of carrying a tag of my own for the very first time. Work had found my family living in the north woods of Wisconsin, or as I fondly remember it, Redneck Central. Whitetail deer hunting was all the rage, and the state deer population was through the roof. In fact, at that particular time, buying a buck tag garnered you two free doe tags. Now, it's important to keep in mind that deer hunting in the Midwest is incredibly different from deer hunting as we know it west of the Rockies. The majority of the season, at least while I was there, was open only to archery, and most guys spent that time in a tree stand over a bait pile. However, the archery season took a hiatus late in the fall, and during that time, there was 1 week of black powder hunting before and after 1 week of rifle season. That rifle season was like nothing I have ever experienced, before or since. To begin with, instead of a spring break, which of course is the standard in most of North America, our school district had a rifle season break, which in my mind was actually counterproductive, as outside of faking sick, hunting was my chief means of missing school. Along with that break, there was a mass migration of hopeful hunters heading into the woods looking for a deer, or three. As most hunters had both buck and doe tags, and as there were no other ungulates in the area, being sure of your target wasn't overly stressed. If it's brown, it goes down, seemed to be the prevailing mindset. The first morning, I quickly realized why Blaze Orange was required. Well before what I would consider legal or even really ethical shooting light, it began. Bang. 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 Bang, 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 bang. If you want to hunt with an SKS rifle, that's fine. If you need an entire clip for one deer, well, that's another matter entirely. For 1 week, it didn't end. The only two deer I saw that week were moving so quickly I never had a chance. My guess is that they didn't either. Ironically, I recently read that deer hunters in the Midwestern states could be considered the largest armed militia in the world. Not long after that experience, we made the long trek back to British Columbia. It was, in my mind, the land of deer, elk, and moose behind every tree. Driving through Banff and Radium on the way back didn't help me to shake that unrealistic belief. But I soon learned that hunting the vast forests of the Monashees, although heavily populated by deer, was still no give me. Nearly two full seasons passed before I finally connected on my first big game animal. It was unceremonious. My dad and grandpa, who you wouldn't think would have such a deep love for road hunting given their history spending weeks at a time in the backcountry of northern and southeastern BC, took me hunting over the Thanksgiving weekend. We made our way up, or I should say my grandpa's 93 single cab Sierra carried us up, to an old fire lookout. We, surprisingly for me, did some spot and stalk hunting without any spotting, and then we retired to sleep in the old lookout with a plan to do some more on-foot hunting in the morning. Two problems presented themselves in conflict to that plan. The first problem was sleep. One person with a snoring issue is bad enough. Two is pure torture. While I'm 100% certain that the two senior members of our party slept well, I can't say the same for myself. The second problem challenged the plan to hunt on foot. We woke up to a thick blanket of snow. Now I know what you're thinking if you know anything about hunting. That's perfect. Well, I agree with you. And so the brave and experienced sheep, goat, and caribou hunters packed up the truck and headed for greener pastures away from the snow. As luck would have it, greener pastures had us cross paths with a young mule deer buck that made some pretty fine pepperoni. While that, my first big game animal, will always hold a special place in my heart, perhaps my proudest hunting moment came a few years later. I was newly married and working at a golf course in the Lower Rainland, which my wife, while my wife finished her last year of school. Life on the golf course involved what I would consider absurdly early mornings, and the 45-minute commute only exacerbated this. Further complicating things were the hundreds of milliliters of rain most months. However, I was able to escape from the insanity for a weekend in October. My wife, my brother, and myself left Abbotsford and arrived in Vernon at roughly 11 p.m. on Friday night. And despite having been up since 4 a.m., there was no way I wasn't going to get up and go hunting in the morning. It would be my only day out that year. And so I woke up early the next morning and headed out. Whereas the year before had been a pushing 30 degrees October 1st when I shot my buck, this fine October day, the typically sunny Okanagan was doing its best impression of the lower mainland. Rain, rain, and rain. I parked the truck at the end of the road, of a road, and started walking the edges of a cut block that had been replanted a few years earlier. After what hadn't seemed like all that long, I spotted a few deer walking a ridge in the distance. Amazingly, I had cell service during the stalk and basically gave a live feed on Facebook of the whole hunt as it was happening. I'm relatively embarrassed to admit that, but it is the truth. Although the buck that I shot on that particular occasion wasn't large, the stalk through relatively open ground left me feeling a great sense of accomplishment. Perhaps too much, as I was able to call in backup for the much further hike out than I had anticipated. The way in always has a way of seeming shorter than the way out. As we all know, reflecting on success is a relatively small part of what hunting is about. As great as it is to share the stories of connecting, the reality is that the success stories are far outweighed by the today wasn't my day stories. But as the today wasn't my day stories began to add up, or begin to add up, we all recognize that there's another type of success. The type that says that no day spent in the woods is wasted. Just over a year ago, and at this time of this reading, probably about 4 years ago, this truth was once again made clear to me. I had the opportunity to head north for just over a week with my dad and two close friends. It was a trip I had dreamed of for years, and although the area we went to was new to me, it was in a certain sense nostalgic. The first reason for this nostalgia was surely due to the countless hours that I had spent poring over Google Earth images, familiarizing myself with the area. The second was the reason I even knew the area existed in the first place. It was the proverbial stomping grounds of my grandfather and my father, the area that they had spent several weeks at a time in back in the 70s. Back then, they would go in on horseback, and a great number of the hours I had spent looking at Google Earth in preparation were spent with my grandfather and my father recounting how the trail they had used worked the landscape while they would tell stories about experiences that they had had in different spots. They talked about the mountain they would climb for sheep, the salt lick they would find moose at, the berry pie that no one, including the horse that would eat anything, would touch, and my personal favorite, the bowl where my dad had shot his first grizzly bear. On that occasion, he was holding down camp while the others had gone out for a short jaunt. He had spotted the bear working its way down the bowl as they were camped, and it was working its way towards their horses. He did what any 13-year-old would do in the situation, and he opened fire. My grandpa joked that he'd never sewed up so many holes on a hide in his life. Unfortunately, my grandfather and along with my grandmother and another couple were badly injured in a car accident in the early 80s when a drunk driver hit them head-on while they were traveling on an old highway between Kelowna and Vernon. The fact that he lived was undoubtedly miraculous. However, his ability to both ride horses and to perform the finer tasks required in taxidermy were lost. The horses were sold and the business was closed, but the stories remained. Those stories, and for my dad, memories, had led the four of us to that hallowed area for an incredible week of hunting. But of course, that week was a week of combined, not my day, stories. And almost every day, one of those stories transpired in dramatic fashion. For example, the first day I had hiked to the top of one of the mountains by our camp. To make a long story short, after busting my butt to crest the summit in order to return to camp, I spotted a very mature caribou chasing a cow the opposite direction I was heading. As the more experienced caribou hunters than I could have told me, you don't catch up to caribou by walking. So I backtracked a whole heck of a lot further than I would have liked to in order to finally get a better look at that bull. He had 5 points on top, but no kicker, which meant he wasn't legal. Close, but not quite. At least I got my cardio in for the day. The next day I had an unexpected surprise. The sheep mountains that my grandfather had talked about in the area were a little bit further than we were planning on hiking, and we were a little late in the season, but I did buy a sheep tag beforehand as I knew there were sheep in the area. While my dad and I were working our way down the trail, the two other members of our party were off on an adventure of their own. My dad and I stopped to glass the south slope of the next mountain. As I set up my spotting scope, I quickly began to see sheep spotting the steep face. As I slowly picked the area apart, one sheep immediately stood out. the animal was facing up and away, but body size and other dead giveaway characteristics always readily visible on sheep told me he was a ram. And if you can't figure that out, you should have paid more attention during the birds and the bees talk you got when you were younger. After a few moments, the ram turned his head and I got a good look at what was a mature ram. Immediately, I knew he was right in the ballpark when it came to the full curl requirement, but it was far too far to know for sure. And by nature, too far to count what we call annuli. And so, my dad and I made a game plan, and I started the ascent up the steep mountain. My plan was to climb a boulder slide paralleling the spot the ram and his companions had bedded down. It was a good plan, except for the fact that rather than staying bedded down, as the internet experts I had previously spent hours reading had said he would, he and his companions had gotten back up and continued their trek across the mountain, leading us to intersect at a place where we were looking at each other from 70 or 80 yards. The mature ram had ducked into a washout while the others continued suspiciously hanging out around the finger where they were keeping me pinned down. While I did eventually work my way above them, things just didn't turn out. The best look I got at the ram was when I had gotten too close to a spot I didn't know he was, and I bumped him. He took off for greener pastures. If you were wondering, my guess is that that ram was a year young and an inch short anyways. Or maybe that's just what I tell myself so I don't lose sleep at night. That trip was filled with experiences like the two that I've just described. A day late and a dollar short. But as previously mentioned, there was no way those not-my-day stories were stories of failure. I'd climb any of those mountains again just for the views that they afforded or the serenity of being away from it all provides. You see, I've often found myself overwhelmed by the vast beauty and mystery that nature holds. It's a feeling I'm certain we all get to one extent or another. And while some would attribute it to the sociological role of evolution, a returning to our roots, and while others would attribute it to some sort of vague spirituality, I would attribute it to the fact that great things are meant to point to greater things. Simply put, creation is meant to point to a creator. Now the man or the woman of science may respond with a simple hogwash. That's religious superstition and nothing more. But may I remind you that cosmology, the branch of science which explores the large-scale properties of the universe, tells us that the universe is in the process of expanding from a single point in the past. Again, to put it simply, the universe began to exist at some point in history. Now, a simple exercise in the rules of logic will tell us that things do not simply begin to exist. In fact, that which begins to exist must have a cause for its existence. Following the said rules of logic, we can safely say that if the universe began to exist, then there must be a cause for its existence. Furthermore, modern scientific theory insists that the universe did begin to exist. Therefore, the universe must have a cause for its existence. Furthermore, that cause must be, of course, outside of itself, something or someone outside of the physical universe who is unimaginably powerful and unimaginably intelligent. At this point, the vague spiritualist, or if you prefer, the agnostic, may intercede. You might say, it may seem that there is something beyond us out there, but there's no way that you can know who or what. That's a fair interjection, as there are many who claim to know the way. Buddhism, Islam, Judaism, Oprah. How can you possibly assert that one of these worldviews has the inside track on what's out there? The simple reply is the historicity of the death and the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. At this point, the person of science may re-enter the conversation. But people don't simply rise from the dead, to which we could respond. That's an assumption based on a universe without an unimaginably powerful and unimaginably intelligent mind behind its existence. Should such a being exist, it's not unreasonable to think that they could indeed raise someone from the dead. And while I could point to the many historical evidences, if you'd like to discuss them, I'd be more than willing to, what I'd rather say is simply this. Could it be that when you stand in the thick timber and feel the eerie silence and magnitude of solitude, or when you sit glassing from a mountaintop and are struck by the vastness of nature, or hike along a mountain stream and note its subtle beauty, that the great things in life are actually pointing to the greatest thing in life, a creator who has made himself known through Jesus of Nazareth.